I'm Dr. Leif Tapanilla from the Idaho Museum of Natural History, and I'm here with Peter Pruitt from Zoo Idaho, and this is The Nature of Idaho. Coming to you from the 1B, Bannock County that is, we're talking all about Idaho, its wild places and wild faces, the natural setting that makes Idaho an incredible place to live and be proud of. Our guest today is Jenna Goodman Campbell, and she's the Stewardship Director for the Oregon Natural Desert Association. Today, Peter, we're talking about juniper trees out here in the West.
Yeah, some people might be a little concerned that this is not Idaho, but it's Oregon.
We have junipers.
We've got lots of Western junipers.
We have an incredible amount. I love junipers. I think they're pretty trees. We're going to talk about how old some of them get, which is pretty remarkable.
Right. It's
definitely like a sign that you're in the West.
Yeah.
And you got the junipers around. But yeah. We're going to learn a whole lot about them.
And, you know, I think with everything in life, an excess of something isn't necessarily good. And we have an excess of Western junipers.
We've got our fill.
Yes.
There are good junipers and maybe not so good junipers.
We'll go with that.
We'll get there.
Yeah.
Okay. Before we get there, nature in the news.
Yeah, Leif. So we've got some research coming out of Northwestern University.
Okay.
Where vivid and lucid dreams may be helpful for creative problem solving.
Vivid and lucid dreams.
Yeah.
Good for us.
Yeah. So when someone says sleep on it, it actually might be solid advice.
Okay. Carry on.
So they were looking at some research and they were using a technique called targeted memory reactivation.
All right.
Or TMR for short.
Good old TMR.
Where during sleep, the researchers played sounds that reminded participants of an earlier attempt to solve specific puzzles. And so when they were giving, and these are very difficult puzzles where they knew that the majority of the test subjects weren't going to be able to answer them.
Sure.
But as they were trying to solve these puzzles, they were listening to specific audio cues at the same time.
Okay.
So when they fell asleep, and this was after they fell asleep, they were played these audio cues. And then they would come back and kind of retake the puzzles and then talk about their dreams. 75% of the participants reported dreams that included elements or ideas related to the unsolved puzzles. And 42% of the dream-related puzzles were solved by those that heard those audio cues versus 17% from a control group.
Okay.
So there is a significant difference for the people who were played those audio cues. They were better at solving the puzzle the next morning. The study, though, was really clear that it doesn't necessarily prove dreaming directly caused the better solutions. It's a potential component. You know, they could have some other things could have been going on after the puzzle where, you know, you get this puzzle and you are continuing to think about it. And then you're working on it even when you're still awake. So there's other things that could be going on as well. But it does open up possible roles of dreaming in emotional regulation, broader learning processes, and mental health and well-being. So dreaming is a good thing to be doing.
Well, that's a relief. So I have two ways of thinking about this. One, can't we just rest and not have to keep working while we're resting?
Right, right.
But the other is, I mean, certainly not a scientific thing, but anecdotally, I feel like I dream and come up with solutions all the time. When I wake up, if I can remember what I was dreaming about, it really seems to help clarify some kind of problem I was dealing with in the day.
Absolutely. And I think all of us have examples where at night they fall asleep, dream, and all of a sudden an idea pops into your mind, you know, a solution or a creative idea to a problem of some sort, you
right.
know, so it definitely helps, right?
Pays to pay attention.
You know, I was also kind of thinking about a previous Nature in the News about AI and how the levels of creativity are increasing.
Sure.
And, you know, as far as we know, AI can't dream yet, so.
Oh, boy. You just gave somebody an idea.
Right.
Careful. All right. Well, our trivia question for today is very much on topic. We're talking about Western junipers. So what is the age of the oldest living Western juniper in Oregon that we know of? When we come back from the break, Jenna is going to join us. We're going to talk all about junipers. You'll want to stay tuned.
Did you miss the latest edition of The Nature of Idaho or ISU's Research, Innovation, and Creativity Insights? Sometimes it's tough to hear your favorite KISU shows live, but you can listen to them on demand with our free KISU mobile app for your Apple or Android device. Search your app store for KISU to get started.
Hey, welcome back from the break. Our guest today is Jenna Goodman Campbell, and she's the Stewardship Director for the Oregon Natural Desert Association. So first off, welcome to the Nature of Idaho.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, I just described that you're from the Oregon Natural Desert Association. Tell us a little bit about what that organization is.
Well, so to those who know us, we are ONDA, O-N-D-A.
O-N-D-A.
So a little bit less of a tongue twister.
Yeah.
And we exist to protect, defend, and restore Oregon's high desert for current and future generations. So we've been around since 1987. So we're coming up on, oh God,
oh yeah,
40 years. Mm-hmm. and I've been with the organization for a long time. I'm coming up on 19 years.
Right on.
And when I first started, I was the wilderness coordinator for the Badlands Wilderness Campaign. So the Oregon Badlands Wilderness is a ancient juniper woodland. So that's how I got my start.
I got it. So what's a stewardship director then?
So I'm the director of the Stewardship and Restoration Program. Like our mission, ONDA has a couple of different parts. We work on conservation advocacy and protecting public lands. And we also work on restoration and stewardship of public lands, tribal lands, private lands. We don't own land. So we work on lands where the land owner or manager wants to partner with us on restoration.
So before we get into junipers, can you kind of describe for our listeners what a high desert is? What are some common components of a high desert? If you travel from Pocatello to Bend, you're going to see you're in the high desert. Basically,
that is the
whole
high
way.
Desert. Exactly.
Yep.
It's really diverse, though. And so we count basically that entire landscape driving from Pocatello to Bend. We even touch some kind of dry pine ecosystems like Malheur National Forest, because the Malheur River is an essential, you know, piece of the high desert watershed. And so of that watershed. So we are pretty broad in how we define the high desert, but, you know, sagebrush steppe is the way that you hear the ecosystem referred to a lot. So bunch grasses, sagebrush, and increasingly juniper are some of the plants that you kind of see and have in common with those landscapes.
So as an environment, obviously high elevation is part of being high desert. And then the desert part is it's what, seasonally dry? How do you describe the precipitation or the moisture levels that are in the high desert?
I'm sure there is like a scientific definition.
Yeah.
But it's, you know, it's just a few inches of rainfall a year.
Right.
A lot of the rain falls as snow. And so that really, you know, drives what plants can survive in the ecosystem. And that will relate to juniper as we talk more about some of the problems that juniper can cause.
And the high desert has, in our area, has always had juniper, correct?
Yes, yep. They are a native species to the high desert. And so some people, especially around here, where you hear a lot about juniper management and kind of the problematic aspects of juniper expansion, a lot of people think that they're like an invasive weed, like a non-native plant. But they are a native plant. They're just very successful native plant.
Well, let's talk, I guess, about the virtues of Western juniper as these, I think, just majestic and charismatic trees, especially the older ones that get very interesting shapes to them and so forth. Why don't you tell us a little bit about junipers?
Yeah, I mean, they're like the life-size bonsai trees. They're super cool. So in the Oregon Badlands Wilderness, we have an ancient juniper woodland. The junipers are growing out of lava formations and then are surrounded by soil that is actually volcanic ash from when Mount Mazama, aka Crater Lake, erupted and deposited 2 to 3 feet of volcanic ash in the Badlands. So they're growing in a really harsh environment. And these trees are just survivors. They have been there for over 1,000 years, some of them. And even the standing dead juniper that no longer have any living branches on them are really important for the habitat. They provide a ton of cavity nesting opportunities for all sorts of animals. And so for the berries and the cones provide a really good food source for a lot of critters as well. So they're an important part of the ecosystem, and they're just incredibly beautiful, as you've mentioned. In their old growth form, they have often have really bright green, fluorescent wolf lichen growing on them. That's a sign of a really healthy ecosystem and clean air, actually. It's also a sign that those are older trees, because those lichens don't start growing until they're hundreds of years old.
They're a native species. Can we talk a little bit about why some people feel that they're invasive? You know, they live in some pretty tough soil, mm-hmm. and you know, they're survivors. So what's kind of causing their proliferation?
So they started to expand in the 1800s, and it correlates pretty closely with settlement and the introduction of livestock and grazing. So livestock grazing and then fire suppression. There were also some climatic changes that occurred around that time that were helpful to the junipers as they were taking off. But those are the two main causes that people have identified is grazing and fire suppression, which basically just allowed junipers to start out competing all of the other plants that that should be more prevalent in the ecosystem. So in a sagebrush steppe habitat, you have sagebrush. Big sagebrush is pretty common, one of the most common, or mountain big sagebrush, those two. And then bunch grasses like Idaho fescue or blue bunch wheatgrass. So those are kind of the big species, the plant species that you see across the sagebrush steppe in a healthy ecosystem. But then juniper trees started to sprout up kind of in these areas, kind of downslope from where you have a lot of old growth junipers. The old growth junipers typically like to grow in really rocky environments like the Badlands. The Badlands is kind of exceptional because it's a true woodland. Most places in the high desert, you see old growth junipers like growing on the rocky ridgetop. So you see this beautiful, you know, kind of ridge line with the rim rock, the lava rock, and then a huge old juniper growing out of like a crack in the rock. And when they're old like that, they're really pretty fire resistant because they develop kind of bare patches on their bark, and they're able to self-prune. They basically can stop one of their branches from growing and basically kill off their own branches to have like one part of the tree continue living. So that's why you see a lot of like dead branches on junipers. But so then in effect, they are like pruning off their lower branches, which is what we do when we want to, you know, make a forest less fire prone. We don't want those ladder fuels for the fire to climb up. And so old growth juniper woodlands are very fire resistant, but the younger trees are prone to fire. So if there were frequent fires coming across the landscape, then you wouldn't have these trees proliferating like they have. But with fire suppression, so it's kind of this 1-2 punch with grazing, taking away competition from some of the other plants, like the bunch grasses, that would be kind of occupying that understory and churning up the soil, allowing the seeds to get in there and germinate. And then you had fire suppression, not allowing those kind of grass fires to burn across the landscape.
So once junipers are able to establish in a disturbed area, for example, I've heard that they are able to put out some chemicals that actually inhibit other plants from starting to, I don't know, colonize and populate the soil.
Yeah, so they everything that makes a juniper tree successful makes it problematic for the ecosystem. So
it's too good at what it does.
I was just thinking, how rude.
Mild herbicide, really? that their needles kind of emit into the soil. So when they drop their needles on the ground, it prevents other plants from surviving around them. But they also intercept a lot of the precipitation, like a high percentage. You know, if you're ever out in a rainstorm in the desert, you find the juniper and you go sit under it because it's going to be pretty dry. And so their needles don't let very much moisture through. And then what moisture does reach the ground, they are able to suck up because they have both a deep taproot, which is the first thing they start growing. And then when they're a few dozen years old, they start to grow these lateral roots. And so they can kind of reach out, you know, a lot wider. And then they're also able to soak up a lot of the moisture from the soil in like early spring before other plants start growing when they're still dormant. And so they just are, they're just really hardy survivors out there. They can suck up all the water. Yeah, they kill off other plants. And then the other thing that's really problematic that we see on a lot of our restoration projects is that then when you don't have other plants growing around them, water that does reach the soil, you get this like overland flows. Mm-hmm. So then you get these like water gullies, rain gullies forming so that when there is a big storm or a lot of snow melt, then you get a lot of erosion, you get more sedimentation in streams, and it's just kind of this downward cycle that you just get this, you know, just cascading kind of impacts in the ecosystem. Oh yeah, and then there's cheatgrass.
Yeah.
So
so question with the needles, as you're working on a restoration project, as you remove these junipers, do you have to do anything with the soil? Is that toxin then in the soil, and does it make it harder once you remove some of these trees and you try to bring in the bunch grasses or the fescue? Do they have a problem then established?
That's a good question. I mean, there are a lot of different methods of juniper removal, and it depends on the size. So when we work with volunteers, we usually are working on juniper removal and with really small juniper trees that volunteers can remove with hand saws, hand tools, or loppers. That's my favorite way to take out a juniper tree. It's just with a nice pair of loppers. So there's not really a concern with them at that level because they're so small. You just toss them aside. But the larger trees, yes, it is kind of problematic. And some of the most effective kind of juniper thinning projects I've seen are ones where they remove the tree and leave a really short stump. And then when they cut off the limbs and pile and burn those. So then you just have a log laying on the ground. Mm-hmm. So that's a lot better for the ecosystem recovery, but it's really labor intensive. And then another use we've had for kind of the juniper skeletons is that we will, once the needles have fallen off the trees, then we'll move those and reposition them to protect like riparian plants like willows or cottonwood or wild rose or other plants that we want to see growing in kind of wet areas, and use them as like a natural cage to mm-hmm. protect those plants so they can get a little bit more mature before deer and elk start eating them.
So how prolific, I guess, are Western juniper at, I'm hesitating to say the word invade because they're from here, but I guess their expansion, I guess, is maybe a better way of saying it. Like, how prolific is it across the West that you see?
I don't know the numbers on that, but they're everywhere.
Yeah.
And they've expanded in a really, I mean, if you look at pictures from, you know, kind of the homestead era.
Yeah.
Versus now, it's striking. You know, you can barely recognize that it's the same landscape except for, you know, contours of the, you know, hillside or something. So they're really everywhere. And, you know, every elevation, every different type of ecosystem. So it is very problematic for the kind of sagebrush, steppe, grassland, and then especially for riparian areas. So, you know, when they're in streams and small kind of spring-fed stream systems, they can basically dry up a stream and then create, like I said, those kind of downstream impacts where you get streams gullying and eroding and just getting pretty entrenched in a, yeah.
And I think of the cascading effects. For example, the removal of beaver from the high desert, mm-hmm. where all of a sudden you don't have these natural dams, where the water table is increasing, and you've got the willows and the other vegetation. You pull the beaver out, things start to dry up. You've got more fire. Junipers move into these streams. They do use water, and they end up removing even more of the moisture within the soil. And it's just this whole cascading effect.
Exactly. Yeah. And the junipers are, you know, a key part of that, unfortunately. So that's kind of our task with the stewardship of, and restoration of these places, is to try to halt that cycle. So we do a lot of restoration focused on enabling beavers to come back to the landscape and resume their kind of management of the floodplain and of riparian areas, so that we can get out of the way. But in order to jumpstart that recovery, we do a lot of work to, you know, both to restore the ability of the place to support beaver if they aren't in residence currently, you know, such as planting and building beaver dam analogs. But removing juniper is a key part of that. Without the juniper removal piece, you can't really have the stream recover.
Is the aim, getting back to some kind of equilibrium, maybe is the goal here, and trimming back juniper, especially in riparian areas near the river, yeah. you know, mm-hmm. it's kind of the main focus. But what's an ideal situation, I guess, so that you have the good juniper and not the the over prolific juniper?
I mean, the ideal situation and where we try to work is in places where grazing has been removed.
Right.
So that you've removed the root cause of the problem. And then we can get in there and, yeah, take out all of the juniper within kind of the whole drainage. And then, of course, in the floodplain. The great thing about having juniper there while we're working is that when we cut them down, we can reuse their limbs and their trunks as building materials for in-stream structures. So, you know, we do actually like it when they're there so that we can reuse those. We don't have to go buy posts for our beaver dam analogs. We can simply use a nice big juniper branch. So we work to reuse kind of all of the material that we can, you know, kind of get it back into the system in a better way. But you're right that it's, you know, ideally we are working to reestablish some balance in the system so that we don't have to be in there constantly tinkering around, that we can let the natural system take off and do its own thing.
So are you working actively on grazing lands as well? Because, you know, I think about that. That's a process that you have to regularly work on. It's not like you can come in, remove the juniper, you know, do the analog beaver dams, get everything set up and let nature take its course. This is something, if you're actively grazing, you have to actively manage the junipers as well.
I think there are a lot of people working on juniper management in, you know, rangeland grazed areas. We try to focus our efforts in places that grazing has already been removed and that are in more of a conservation status, so that we can see those lasting impacts and demonstrate what can happen, you know, to a landscape when you actively restore it and restore beavers to the landscape. So it's, I think it's a huge issue across Central and Eastern Oregon. And a lot of ranchers and ranching interests have come on board with juniper removal. So we do have a few projects in partnership with entities like the Burns Paiute Tribe, where we've helped remove juniper from landscapes that are still grazed. So, you know, with a partner who's really wanting to maintain that, we will work on those types of projects. But ultimately, we're looking to work in places where grazing isn't a factor anymore.
Let's come back to the virtues of our dear juniper. So
You really want us to
I want
junipers.
You to love the juniper.
Gotcha.
I know.
Gotcha.
They're beautiful.
Yeah.
I think what we're learning here is there can be too much of a good thing.
Yep.
Yeah.
That they can be displacive of other plants that make a balanced ecosystem, mm-hmm. especially near, you know, in the watershed.
Yes.
And, you know, in previous shows, and I think there's a general awareness, hopefully increasing awareness, that having junipers on your land next to your house or structures mm-hmm. is a, you know, a thing you want to avoid because they are really good at catching fire and catching fire to other things.
The young ones are good at catching fire.
The young ones, yes.
Yes.
Which, you know, let's talk
several
about
several hundred years old.
Let's talk about the old ones. So I'm impressed by junipers for a number of reasons, but one is that they get to live really long if conditions are right or whatever, right? And so the trivia question, which we'll get to, is how old is the oldest living Western juniper in Oregon? But can you speak to, in your region, Oregon, like old stands of juniper and what they're like?
Yeah, so you can tell like pretty quickly once you know the differences. So an old juniper tree, they get really gnarled. They'll twist around on themselves
yeah.
in really cool ways. They have branches that are, as I said, you know, they'll have dead branches, but often those branches are like twirling around, twisting spirals. No old growth juniper is the same as another. They are like snowflakes. They are all unique. And I get kind of bored hiking in other forests sometimes because I'm used to the old growth junipers that are so cool. You know, compared to a young juniper, you know, you see like a more of a domed top. Less old juniper they're more of a kind of a Christmas tree shape. They are symmetrical. They'll have branches all the way, you know, kind of down toward the ground. Their bark is more kind of thin and flaky, whereas with old growth junipers, you get really deep furrowed red bark, and it has these kind of longer papery strips. And then you get those beautiful kind of bare, what looks like dead wood, but is actually just, you know, a living or a part of the tree that has kind of died off, but it's still a living tree. So they're just really a beautiful part of the landscape. And especially, you know, if you're hiking up on a ridge and you see one and you get to sit in its shade, you just feel like you're, you know, in the presence of some old wise being.
Well, so help us out. Answer our trivia question. As far as we know, right, the oldest in Oregon Western juniper that is still alive is how old?
It is 1600 years old.
Wow.
Between 1600 and 1680. So that's kind of the time range that we know on that tree. I wouldn't be surprised at all if, you know, within the Badlands Wilderness, there are trees that are much older than that. But that is the one that has been, you know, core sampled that has been dated to 1600 years old. So that's pretty cool.
That's humbling to think about that kind of age.
It really is.
Yeah.
And it's very humbling to, you know, walk amongst the really old junipers in the Badlands, knowing that, yeah, that they've been there for that long. Some of the dead standing ones, they say, you know, could be upwards of, you know, 5,000-6,000 years old. We don't know. And that in itself is kind of humbling too.
Time.
Just a little blip.
Love it.
Yeah. Awesome. So Jenna, thank you so much for joining us today. And for our listeners who want to learn more about the Western juniper, go to the Oregon Natural Desert Association website, onda.org. And again, Jenna, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
The Nature of Idaho receives support from listener contributions to KISU. Shows are produced at the KISU studios in Pocatello at Idaho State University with editing and production by Mackenzie Young. Music is by Idaho's very own Sons of Bannock. Audio of all past episodes can be found at KISU.org and select podcast services. Send your thoughts and suggestions to noidkisu@isu.edu.